we are in awe by how artificial intelligence learns by itself, right? We just let it loose with the latest developments and it plays itself over and over again. But it's the same how kids learn. It's like if we would let our kids loose in an environment where they can break things, and we let our kids grow up in permissionless environments where they don't need to ask for things, we build the most important aspect that a child inherits naturally.
Welcome back to another week of Rerouting, Navigating Parenthood. This week, we talked with Sebastian Rumberg. Listen in as he shares how he and his wife arrived at the decision to leave Berlin behind for good and buy a farm in the middle of nowhere. Did they adjust to life at a slower pace? Will they regret leaving the big city? Do they feel like their kids are missing out? Find out next on Rerouting.
Good to see you guys here.
Good morning.
Thanks for having me.
I just want to get started with asking you, what have you been up to, Sebastian, this morning?
It's a good question. So we basically just got up and we prepared the kids for kindergarten, sent it off to the forest. and we had the chimney sweeper visiting us because the farm needed some maintenance.
The farm needed some maintenance?
Yes, just because, I don't know how, if people are still familiar with it, but when you own a house, the chimney sweeper comes regularly once or twice a year just to sweep the chimney, basically.
Oh, wow. I thought that was just in the fairy tales still.
No, so that's still a regular thing. The good thing is, so the kids this morning were standing in front of the window and just basically watching her climbing up the ladder and then sweeping the chimney. They still look like they do in the fairy tales. It's incredible.
Now we know, Tiffany, why we wanted to get Sebastian to this podcast. <Very
excited. laughs> living the fairy tale life.
Deep told me about you, and I was just instantly so excited to hear this entire story and about what you guys have going on. And it's funny for me because I grew up in a really tiny village and had a little girl. I'm a single mom for a really long time. And I said, we have to go to the city. I have to get you out of here. I have to show you the world. You have to meet all these people and have all these experiences. And I mean, it was a total reversal from what you guys have done. And so I'm just so excited to hear about how somebody comes from the other side of that and then ends up going out into the village.
So yeah, so I was born in 1986 in Eastern Germany, close to Dresden, small town, 40,000 inhabitants. And I grew up in a very traditional family setup. I think that's what you would call traditional these days, right? So my father was working a lot. My mother took care of my sister and myself. And that's how I spent the first, 18 years, really well protected. We had a small house with a little garden, and in the small city, not much was going on. So there's really nothing remarkable. Almost everything has been just quiet for the first 18 years, at least how I remember. The occasional fights with my sister, but even the two of us got along very well. And now looking back, I feel like my life basically started after I finished my A-levels with first went to Australia, the traditional work and travel setup where you go there for a year and you explore who you actually are. When I came back, I realized that I changed quite a bit. And while I've been abroad, I started to write a diary for my friends back home, my family. I spent more time in front of the computer writing the story than I actually took time to experience what I'm just writing about. So I thought, well, that makes me a writer, right? So I think I want to be an author. What I liked about the idea of being an author back then was that when you publish the book, you don't really know who the author is, but the work that you're producing is front center, and nobody really cares about the person who wrote it. And I really like the idea of that it's not about myself, but whatever I produce that people interact with. But I soon realized I don't have much to say. Right. I neither have the patience to write a book or finish a book, nor do I have the experience to really come up with something that is profound for people to spend hours reading whatever I come up with. So instead of trying to become a book author, I thought, well, maybe I can still do the writing and become a journalist. And I think probably that's the key lesson, number one, that I liked writing or making the world better through writing. And I think the second realization is I really don't need much from anything, right? So before I went to Australia, my parents and I, we went to Globetrotter, which is one of these, you know, huge outdoor chains where you buy all the expensive equipment. And we went there and I told the man who was working there, I'm going to Australia and I want to visit the Outback. So he sold me a sleeping bag, which where he said, you know, it can be really cold in the Outback, minus 10, minus 20 degrees. And I have no idea how Australia is. So I bought this really expensive sleeping bag, which cost a fortune. It was really heavy. It was really big. And when I went to Australia, it never dropped below 20 degrees. So because the sleeping bag was so expensive, I felt guilty to throw it away. So I was carrying around the sleeping bag with me for 1 year, and, but I never used it. It was way too hot to use it.
You were hanging out at the beaches of Melbourne all the time.
No. I was actually, you know, traveling the whole country, even also through the Outback. And I started with a 75-liters backpack, like huge, right? It was packed to the very top with, I don't know how many spare clothes I had. And so I arrived in Sydney, and in the hostel that I booked, there were only Scots and Irish people. And I did my major in English literature, right? So I thought, I can interpret Shakespeare. You know, I know all the really complicated English words. But when I came there to the kitchen and all of the Irish and Scots were talking to each other, I didn't understand a single thing. I couldn't even ask for the cutlery, right? Because I had no idea what cutlery was in English. So it took me the first 2 or 3 months to actually get accustomed to it. But one thing I remember I admired, so you could instantly tell the people who arrived in Sydney for work and travel that were like me with a huge backpack prepared for anything. You know, I was probably even prepared for World War III to happen. And the people who have been traveling the country, they almost had nothing in their backpack, right? They had probably one or two spare trousers, they had two shirts. The smaller the backpack, the longer they've been on the road. And I really admired that in the very beginning. And slowly, my backpack got smaller and smaller, except for the sleeping bag. Like, I carry that around because I'm German and, you know, my parents paid the sleeping bag. So for the rest, I threw away. And at the end of the year, I think I had one trouser, where people left phone numbers and messages, and I had a couple of shirts and underwear, that sort of thing. But everything else was just, I was happy with nothing, right? And I think that was one of the other lessons that I realized is that I don't need much at all. And it's a thing that I kept for myself ever since afterwards, which relates to now us living on a 3,500 square meters farm with, I don't know, I think it's 14 rooms in the main building, and we have two other buildings, which is another interesting thing, which we're going to cover in a second, I guess. But I'm not passionate about it. I think that's one of the key realizations as well, is I don't need it. And I think that, which is very liberating. So we own this thing right now, and it makes sense financially as well. And for the kids, and for our life as a family, it's really rewarding, because any afternoon, whenever, any morning, the kids can just go outside and they're instantly in a well-protected space, right? Because 3,500 square meters garden and woods and that sort of thing, and they can just play. But if we would lose it the next second, I wouldn't mind. I know we would still be happy as a family, because it doesn't matter if we spend our day in a single room. I think that's what our kids love the most, if we actually spend time together. And it doesn't have to be anything fancy, right? We don't need to live through adventure. We don't need to live through anything. So Josephine is 5 and Theodore is 4. They just love for us to play cards, draw anything, right? Play with Lego. But of course, we spend a lot of time outside during the summer, autumn, and spring.
You know what, Sebastian? It's so funny to me, because when you were talking about your giant backpack that you started with in Australia, I don't know about you guys, but when my daughter was born, like, I had this giant diaper bag. Like, you need everything, right? Yeah. Like, just in case anything happens. And it's like, well, what's going to happen? Like, they might need a new diaper. What else happens? Like, you don't need, and you have this giant, it's like an army surplus bag, and you're like carrying that with you everywhere, and all this equipment and strollers and baby beds that are portable. And by the end of that first year, at least if you were me, you were like, there's a diaper in there. There's a public bathroom if anything goes really awry. And a baby spoon if I need a smash up, but that was just like randomly in my purse. And you just realize, like, kids just don't need that much. Like, they are so portable. And I think that's probably just like like fear-based thing, like, well, just in case, I want to be prepared. You know, you had this entire thing for anything that could possibly happen, even if it dropped below 10 degrees in the, you know, Australian outback, this giant sleeping bag. And then you realize as life goes on, yeah, so maybe not all that was necessary.
I think that as well is a universal theme that we all experience multiple times throughout life, right? It's the same with parenthood. It's the same when you start a new job. You start as an idiot, which you always have to go through the phase because nobody knows everything from the very beginning. And you come up with all of the various things that could go wrong. And you soon realize, oh, well, the world didn't end, even though one of the worst cases just happened, right? So the four projects that I recently started over the last 2 and a half now, I didn't know anything about any of them. So I didn't know how to build a school. I don't know how to build a village. I don't know how to publish a book. And I certainly didn't know how to be a parent. All of these four projects somehow, even though I'm not an expert at all, they somehow became something. The phases have always been the same, what you just described, Tiff. So I can totally relate to that.
Yeah, I imagine so. And it's nice to have a little lighter pack.
You know, so up till for at least good 15, 20 years of my life, I lived just off one suitcase, right? And then suddenly this thing happens, you know, you get thrown into fatherhood or parenthood. So if I have to move houses now, I think I need like 2 truckloads of stuff to move now. So I'm just figuring out, you know, what happened. And the reason why I'm, you know, interested in talking about this, Sebastian, is, you know, you went through a similar life cycle, right? You came back from your travels, you had a pretty strong professional life, you lived in a city, and then you suddenly decided to move to this farm, and you've been able to inculcate the same values to your kids that, you know, you don't count on things. Unpack this for me. How did that happen? You know, how did you reconcile this with your family?
So I can totally relate to what you just mentioned. My life has been exactly the same. So I was living on 45 square meters in Berlin. I arrived in the city, I think it was 2011, after I finished my studies in Leipzig, when the startup scene started to get on the national map and international map around Berlin. And that's when I joined the first startup that I was working for. And I was living a happy life, 45 square meters. I had a mattress on the floor. I had a couple of books, actually a lot of books. I probably more books than anything else in the apartment. And there was a small kitchen and a small bathroom, just like you just described. And I didn't need anything more for the next couple of years. I think I was working 80 to 90 hours a week. And then I met Franzi in 2013. I was protecting my freedom, so I didn't want a relationship. And now it gets personal, but I think it's probably relatable because I thought, well, if I'm now with Franzi, I'm not going to change the world. But after 1 year, her being very persistent, I gave up, that's it. And then things started to develop quite quickly. So Josephine was born in 2015, Theodore in 2016. We got married in 2015. And as soon as we had Fina, we moved outside of Berlin because we realized it's hard for us to raise the kids in the apartment. So Franzi was living in Charlottenburg, which is one of the more well-developed districts in Berlin. And we're living next to this massive street packed for hours a day with cars. And we thought, well, I don't know. That's probably not how we would like to raise our kids. So we moved outside of Berlin, close to Potsdam. We rented a house, which quite expensive back then, but I think that's normal. I think we paid 1,200 euro per month just to live in the house with a little garden.
Yeah, with a garden. That's prime real estate in Berlin.
True. And actually, so the small village was called Rehbrücke, which probably nobody has ever heard of. But 4 years ago, all of the new millionaires, they started to buy the real estate there, right? And when we decided maybe it's time to not rent a house anymore, but maybe we buy it, we were looking at real estate there, and it was already 500,000. So it was way off from what we could possibly afford ourselves. Because now we had 2 kids and we were both working. We realized without family around, we don't have the support that we need in order to make this life happen somehow. So we either moved to where my parents live, close to Dresden in Saxony, or we would move to where Franzi's parents live in Dessau, which nobody has ever heard of except if you're into architecture. And I think it was in 2016 that by chance, Franzi discovered this farm in Moosigkau, where we now live, and it was up for sale. Mm. And Franzi told me, ever since I've been a little girl, I wanted to live on a farm. I wanted to build a family there. I wanted to own animals, have the kids grow up there. And because I had nothing better to do, because I haven't changed the world until then, and I realized, well, I don't have a better idea, so why don't we follow your dream? So when I came to Berlin, I think I was inspired by all of the stories that you now read on TechCrunch and all of the other big publications, where a founder came up with an idea and against all odds made it happen, made it big, right? I always thought, that needs to be me. I need to come up with an idea myself and I need to make it happen. But two of the most successful ideas of my life haven't been my ideas. I think they came in conversations with Franzi. So the farm was her idea, where we now happily live. And the school also wasn't my idea. It was just in a conversation with Franzi that I had, where once we moved here in 2017, we somehow got to talk about where do we want to send them to school. And because it's Franzi's home city, she knew all the schools. And she said, well, there are decent schools, but just across the street from our farm, there's this old 10,000 square meter schoolyard that has been abandoned, that has been empty for a couple of years. And when we moved there, we thought, well, here's a schoolyard. Why don't we build a school ourselves? We have no idea how it works, but maybe somebody else would like to do it as well.
Before you go to the school part, I'm actually really curious to know, and this is, again, I'm asking this question on behalf of my son more than anybody else, right? I would love to know, what's your lifestyle like in this farm? So build that out in full flavor for us, just so that we get an idea.
Yeah, Deep, I too want to know. I mean, I grew up in a small town in America, but like, what kind of, do you have animals on this farm? Like, are you guys milking cows? Are you growing things? Like, and if you have cows, like, can I come milk a cow? Build this out for me. I need to know more about this farm situation.
So right now we have two dogs and two cats. When Josephine is going to school, she gets chicken.
Now it's a legit farm.
Exactly. So before that, it's not been a real farm, but our neighbors, they have horses, they have ducks, they have pigs. They don't have cows anymore. Other farms here do have cows, but in our direct neighborhood. So the horses from our neighbors, they sometimes, or actually quite often, roam our garden because they eat the grass here. And it's, I can send you beautiful pictures. When we moved here in 2017, at that time I was commuting twice a week to work from the office. I stopped talking to my colleagues about my life on the farm. I didn't want to make them sad, right? So here are the two worlds that were colliding in the office. When we talked about our kids and our life and what happened during the week, the story that I heard from my colleagues, our neighbor from upstairs at 4 in the morning kept shouting, hearing loud music. We took half an hour U-Bahn ride to get to the next playground with our kids, and it was packed there. And I had to keep quiet because I had no intention of making my colleagues sad or envy, because I could only say things, well, I opened the front door and the kids have been playing outside and, and then we were sitting there on horses. So I stopped talking because it was just the ideal lifestyle, how you would want your kids to grow up. And a concept that we talked about before was this permissionless space, which is really rare in a city, right? In most of the environments, how society happens these days and how our kids grow up, they are environments that are packed with things where you need to ask for permission or that you simply can't do, right? So the playgrounds are state-owned. The kindergartens where we put our kids, they are most of the time private-owned with all of the regulations. Our apartments are rented. They belong to landlords. So we can't break things and we can't renovate things because, well, that needs to be done by a craftsman that you need to pay. So all the time, we can't allow our kids to explore the environment that they would like to. And what amazes me now, we are in awe by how artificial intelligence learns by itself, right? We just let it loose with the latest developments and it plays itself over and over again. But it's the same how kids learn. It's like if we would let our kids loose in an environment where they can break things, and it doesn't matter, for example, forests is the perfect example, right? Forests, I think, are the ideal playground. It's free. You can go to any forest that you want. And if the kids smash a stick against the tree, it doesn't matter because there are a million broken branches already that you can use. It's super important that we let our kids grow up in permissionless environments where they don't need to ask for things. And it's the same with our backyard. We try to let them do as much as possible without interfering. I think we built the most important aspect that a child inherits naturally is self-confidence that needs to build over time. And we only build confidence if we succeed on our own. And you don't need a farm to raise your kids, right? And if you live in a city right now, I think you still have all the potential to raise your kids happily, because what do they need for the first 7 years? Attention from the parents, love and taking care, and just enough confidence from the parents that you encourage your kids to say, you know what, you figure it out yourself. Just go. And you put them somewhere. And I like forests the most. And I not zoos, not playgrounds, but actual forests, rough, natural environments. I find it incredible.
That's an interesting point. And I think that's also a good segue. Tiffany, I don't know if you've got something to ask on the...
Yeah, first of all, I have to say, you know, I don't know if you've heard the term helicopter parent, but it is a huge phenomenon in the U.S. And I had a little girl who was in the NICU. So for the first couple of years, she lived in a bubble because I was so afraid. And then at a point, I realized, like, actually, you don't like live to not really live. And so I kind of started letting go and letting her figure out where her boundaries were. And it was incredible to see other people on the playground panicking that I was allowing her to, like, you know, climb and like maybe fall. And the thing is, children learn their boundaries this way. And being in Germany, I see that culturally it's very different here. And I think they have a lot longer leash. But when you talk about the Waldorf and that your wife came up with this idea to have this school, and she knew the schools in the area, but felt like that wasn't really the thing that you guys wanted. What concepts were you exploring? Like, or was it just like the Waldorf? We know about it. This is exactly it. Or how did you guys arrive and say, like, no, this is the one for us. This is what we need to do.
I think just like the rest of our life, it was more of a, you can either call it destiny if you believe in destiny, or you call it an accident. So it's just happened. We discovered this long-term documentary on television. I think it was actually YouTube, where this documentary team followed a Waldorf class from the first grade to eighth grade across, you know, the first 8 years, and they put it in a three-series documentary. And that was at a time when we were briefly thinking about it would be cool to have a school. So we didn't make up our minds yet. And after the documentary that I watched with Franzi, I think we binge watched the whole thing. There was then probably, I don't know, 5 to 6 hours. And everything that the teacher said in the documentary, that the kids mentioned, that the parents mentioned, ring the bell with us, right? How the whole concept worked. And before then, I wasn't familiar with Waldorf, except that they could dance their own name, right? All the cliches, I had heard them as well, and I thought, well, I have no idea. And when we watched the documentary, and Franzi and I think we instantly thought that this would be an attractive model, and we briefly looked at other models, but not so much. We thought, why do any more research? The next thing that Franzi did, she just wrote an email to a couple of Waldorf schools, and it roughly said, we are parents from Dessau. There's no Waldorf school here. We would like to build a Waldorf school. We don't know how it works. Could we visit you for half an hour? And they replied, of course, come over for half an hour and I answer your question, like the CEO from the school told us. And we went there, and the Waldorf school in Halle is just insanely beautiful. It's this construction from 16th century, I think, really old, beautiful, renovated buildings. They have animals, they have bees, they have all of these different buildings where kids can explore different crafts around metal, around wood. The kitchen is also partly run by the kids, so they prepare their own meal, which they grow in their backyard. It's all
nice,
locally produced. Mm-hmm. And when we went there, and instead of half an hour, we spent 6 hours together with Alex. And after that visit, Franzi and I, we knew that's what we want as well. So in Dessau, you have two Facebook groups. I think one has 10,000 members and the other has 5,000 or 6,000 members. All we did is we wrote a very short post, again, using the same true anecdote where we said, we just moved here. We don't know how it works, but it would be nice to have a Waldorf school. Would anyone else be interested? And from that post, I think 120 people showed up we rented a little room in the village.
And these people are from that village, the people who chose and
from all over Dessau. So
nice.
And then at the same time, even though it was just an idea, I think we already had 30 kids put on the list to be a pupil in our school to be at one day. And afterwards, we built a nonprofit, and everything else afterwards was just fixated on the idea. We want to open a Waldorf school here. We roughly put together a website, right? And we updated regularly on the Facebook groups just to keep people updated. And one thing that is beautiful, which I realized is it's an incredible asset to have in these smaller areas that are not Berlin, that are not Hamburg, London, Seattle, is if you start something from scratch, a new project, people are, I think, a lot more excited because something happens in their small area, right? If we would have announced a new school in Berlin, nobody would have cared because you have all of the offerings here already, even though they are packed already and it's hard to get in. But because we announced the idea, just the idea that we would like to build a school and we don't know if it works in Dessau, people got a lot more excited and we got a lot of support also from the local authorities and from the press.
They're really invested in the place. And it's not, it's maybe not so much of a strategy to get into them. You know, they want to cover what the people care about where they live.
Exactly.
I really love, I mean, this all sounds so cool. And I definitely want to bring my daughter and visit and see the farm and this permissionless space to play in and explore. But I'm curious, for those of us who are just not ready or able to abandon our urbanite lifestyles, how do we bring pieces of what you've made your entire life? Like, how do we introduce pieces of that to our own children and in our own families and daily lives here in the city?
So I'm a big fan of Jordan Peterson. And he said one interesting thing in his book, 12 Rules for Life, where he said, compare yourself to who you were yesterday and not somebody else. That's a concept I try to live by, even though it doesn't work all the time for me. So I compare myself to all of these people out there as well, right? The people who achieved more, who lived a more incredible life, at least from what I can perceive publicly. But I always try to come back to this concept, and I think that is key, right? You don't read on the internet and you don't follow my life. You just take inspiration from what you think. And I think the beautiful thing is we all instantly know where we want to improve or what we want to achieve, because I think in part because we get jealous or feel envy about things that other people have already. And this envy, this feeling, I think is the driving force to make a difference in our own life. And when you then apply the tiny steps, just really tiny ones, and instead of comparing your whole life to somebody else completely, and if we would now switch around and you would tell me about your life deep and tiff, I would be jealous about parts as well. But you come back to what you have, what you can work with, and then you can make small adjustments. I think the first thing is spend more time with your kids, right? I would cut back completely on television, on social media. I think that's in smartphone. I try not to look at my smartphone, and I don't read social media. I don't watch television. And that's liberating a couple of hours per week already. It's insane how much time we spend on these different channels. And this is the time that we don't spend with our kids, right? Or doing whatever we want. Does it make sense?
It does. It's beautiful. And what surfaces for me is that, you know, what you see right now is not only just a manifestation of some radical choices, but even those simple action steps that you've taken, right, that have got you along this way. I think we're running close to the end of this time. What I would really love to know, and Tiffany, you can jump in and tell me if that's the angle you want to take as well, but I'm curious to know really how these choices that you've made have transformed your kids and what is coming up in terms of their upbringing. You know, how are they growing up? How do they look at all these things? And how has it shaped their personality?
Of course, to the best of my abilities, I try to be a good dad, but I don't know how the kids will turn out eventually, right? So we can only tell afterwards in a couple of years, looking back and looking at their kids, what they are as grown-up adults. If we did everything, or if we did things right, we don't do everything right. I think we make a lot of mistakes as well all the time. So we can only tell afterwards if we did things right or wrong. And in all honesty, I think we actually have a tendency to do things the exact wrong way, what we didn't want to do, right? I can see that also with Franzi and myself. We see what we didn't like about how our parents raised us. Like, it can be anything, if they've been super harsh or they haven't been there for us. So we try to do the exact opposite because we think, well, that's what we were missing. So we want to give it to our kids,
right,
which again produces the exact opposite. So our kids naturally will probably look at us this way and think, I don't want to be like that in my own kids. So it's almost like this
sinuscript.
Yes, exactly.
You can never be right.
Exactly. You can never be right. But there are probably three principles that I try to raise the kids by. First, I try to get out of their way as much as possible. So I encourage them to, and I'm not, it's not technically true. I mean, most of the time, if I look at my kids, I'm just in love. And I tell them, I don't know how many times a day I tell them, you know what, I love you. And I tell them, oh my God, you're the most amazing kids. I'm probably spoiling them, right? There you have it. But then for the rest of it, whenever they do something, I try not to intervene. If they draw something, if they show it to me, I don't say, oh my God, I love it. You know, you're the best. It's not true. I say that, but I try not to as much because I want them to be proud of themselves. The second thing is, which I've now covered already, I try to give them as much love as possible, which I think comes naturally, right? So there's nothing that I think of. And the third thing, which I think is probably that's one thing I think is clever, is that I tell them I work as an inventor. And because they are young enough to still admire us, they are now inventors as well. And being an inventor comes naturally with, I think, two important key aspects that are important for life, for them to develop fully, is they're not afraid of failure because we need to fail because we are inventing something new that has never happened before. So now our kids want to be inventors as well, which I encourage, right? Before that, because Francie's a doctor, Fina wanted to be a doctor as well, and Theodore wanted to be a fire worker and a policeman and an astronaut, of course. So he still wants to be that. And
Exactly.
But what I like about them trying to be inventors as well is that they don't take this famous path that's already taken, but they try to find a new one. And the transformation that I saw instantly within 48 hours of when they decided they want to be inventors as well is that they were less afraid of failure and they were happy to make mistakes. And that's what I encourage them. I tell them, you know what, even if they, for example, Theodore is now at the age where he plays around with Lego a lot and he builds things and they break all the time. But when I saw that it might actually work, what we've come up with is that when things broke before that, he would be sad. He's still sad every now and then, or probably quite often. But these other times, he just said, oh, that didn't work. And he goes instantly back to work. And he built something different that he hasn't envisioned before. And I think that might probably just be good ideas for kids in general.
I love it. Right. I absolutely love it.
I love that. That fluidity of life between farm and computer and kids and Waldorfschule. Sebastian, very nice to talk to you and get a sneak peek on what life is like. I can't wait to visit you and be there and see what you're growing. Pluck some tomatoes from your plants and have some fresh
chicken.
Yeah. Chicken. it was beautiful. If people want to find out and follow you, where can they do that?
I think LinkedIn might be the best place because this is the only network that I get myself to publish. I tried Facebook. Not Facebook, I abandoned. I tried Twitter, but I'm not clever enough to say interesting things in 280 characters.
Then is there a website we could send people to if they wanted to learn more about either the school or the farm or the co-working space?
So I think eva.so might be the best bet for the whole co-working space and village. It has an email sign-up form, nothing else. But I want to publish there more. One day I will.
Cool, fantastic. Sebastian, signing off. Thank you so much. And have a good work at the farm.
Yeah, thanks, guys. You too. Bye-bye.
All right, guys. If you've been enjoying the show, don't forget to rate us on Apple Podcasts and Spotify. And if you want some more goodies, come to readoutingpod.com.